it's nice, isn't it?
You're an old sucker, aren't you, Jim?
Well, a guy got into the lift with me today, and he was beautifully dressed, and he had a dozen red roses and some expensive-looking cupcakes in the other hand, and he was going nervously up to one of the floors in the building, and I said, good luck, and he looked at me and smiled and said, thank you. And I thought, oh, that's nice. So I take it you're buying nothing?
No, not very much, I've got to say. I haven't done anything yet. On the way home, I'll try and...
By the side of the road, someone will be selling flowers.
Yes, one hopes still at this late part of the day.
Some opportunist.
Well, you don't have to bother because your wife is away.
No, she's back now. They got back on Sunday.
Oh, you mean she was listening to this rant about your mother-in-law earlier?
Well, she was listening, yeah. I don't think her mother was.
She may be now.
Can you recommend any good hotels in the city?
I would recommend a great many roses and maybe expensive boxes of chocolates on your way home.
Or a trip to Uzbekistan, where I believe Valentine's Day has been cancelled.
Really?
Why?
Are they just skipping the 14th altogether?
No, supposedly they... instead, you can hear poetry by a 16th century Mughal emperor. Because Valentine's Day is a corrupt Western influence.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, the Japanese love it. They have a fantastic way of celebrating it there. Morinaga, the chocolate company, back, I think it was 50s or 60s, decided that this would be a fantastic thing to celebrate because the Japanese hadn't latched onto it yet. And they said, well, we're going to introduce this thing, Valentine's Day, who's going to celebrate it. And the rule that they came up with was that all the women had to buy chocolate for all the men. And so, that, for example, in the office, so, you know, Susan will buy chocolate for you, Jim, for example, yeah? Because that's what...
So you buy for your colleagues?
Yes. Not just family, or, and it wasn't a romantic thing, it's any man you are somehow in your group, whatever group it might be, school or work, or whatever it might be, the women buy chocolate for the men.
Okay.
And the great half the country suddenly had to buy chocolate, so Morinaga realised that meant that half the country weren't buying chocolate, which was a major marketing flaw. So they then actually invented, and I'm not making this up, although I sometimes weep when I think about these things. They invented a second one. March the 14th in Japan is now called White Day. And it's bizarre. They came up with this new concept where now, on White Day, the men are supposed to buy chocolate for the women. The thing is, they realise that if it's just men give chocolate to the women, they'll simply save the chocolate from the 14th of February and give it back. So guess what they give on White Day?
What?
White chocolate. To stop them from re-gifting the chocolate. It's absolutely inspired.
The first known Valentine, of course it comes from St. Valentine, but there are various stories. But the first known poem, Valentine poem, in English, composed in 1477 by Marjorie Bruse to her fiancé, who was a bit fickle. And it's actually quite modern.
Have you got the poem there?
Yeah. And if you command me to keep me true... If you command me to keep me true wherever I go, indeed I will do all my might you to love and never anyone else. And if my friends say that I do amiss, they shall not stop me from doing so.
And they do often, don't they? The friends, that poor guy who comes in with the chocolates. I don't know about him. No,
oh,
not right.
I've seen him. Look at him.
He's not right for you. No.
He's no better than he ought to be.
It was the same in 1477.
That's right.
But you notice what she basically says, I will try to be true to you. I'll do my best, but, you know. No guarantees, no promises.
My heart me bids evermore to love you truly over all earthly things. Oh, Marjorie, I hope it turned out well.
Yeah.
To someone named John. All right, 23 minutes to 5 o'clock. Tim Watkins on the panel and Steve McCabe is too. What would they like to talk about, Steve?
Well, we're back at school now. School's been back in for a couple of weeks and we're starting to see how everything's shaking out. And I've noticed that I've got a lot of kids standing in front or sitting in front of me at the moment. One or two have to stand for the first few days because I don't have enough seats in my classroom. Because I've got, in some classes, over 30. We've got, and this is kind of a bit of a rant, possibly a bit of a whinge, I don't know, but it needs saying. We've got in the secondary teachers' collective agreement, our working conditions contract, we've got a provision that says that schools are supposed to endeavour to ensure a maximum average class size of 26 students per teacher. And that's in there. And it's fascinating the language that gets used, that schools are supposed to endeavour, and that's a wonderfully vague phrase. And it means that you're entitled to fail. Now, there are provisions meant to be put in place if that requirement isn't met. I've got an average class size at the moment of 27, and so I'm starting talking to my employers about what they're going to do to make it up to me that they're breaking this requirement. This is a provision that the PPTA have been fighting to keep in for quite some time. The best we can still get is this endeavour to. The ministry aren't even willing to commit to average class size of 26 for teachers. And what's bothering me about this is the fact that the PTA often get dismissed as simply being how should we say, troublemakers who are just trying to kick up a stink and trying to get excessively wonderful provisions for teachers. This is the best that we've been able to get so far, is an average class size of 26 and endeavours toward it. If the ministry, and frankly, I don't believe this is true at the moment, if the ministry actually genuinely cared about providing for good working conditions for teachers so that we could then do a good job and do our very best for the kids that we teach, and ultimately that's where this is going, we are trying to do a good job for our kids. It's not simply to give us an easy day at the work. We want to be able to do the job to the best of our ability. If they actually cared about that, we wouldn't be simply stuck with this, well, we'll do our best for you, but if we can't, then you'll have to understand. I'd like to see, instead of an endeavour for an average maximum class size of 26, how about we can actually get some hard and fast rules in place? I'd say around 26 would be a good number for a maximum class size.
There is a solution to this.
Hire more teachers?
No, you make it all secret under the Official Information Act, so the media never learn about it and never becomes an issue, Steve, except for you.
Send those extra children, tell those extra children they can't come to school and leave them outside the gates.
Ooh, I could put a turnstile at my door, couldn't you? Like, right. First 26 coming, say, sorry, mate.
27th, yeah, off you go.
Little Johnny,
go.
Bugger off. Yeah. I love that one.
But you see, Tim Watkin, you were saying before, you know, we're a rich country. And a few people would have raised their eyebrows at that. I mean, this is a resourcing issue. Are we a rich country anymore? Because the promising of lower class sizes, even though we heard, in the not-too-distant past that class size doesn't matter, the promising of them has gone right back, I can remember, to David Longley.
Yeah, absolutely. We are rich enough. I mean, I think a living wage, we're rich enough for that. To be fair, I would put a living wage higher than a class size issue. So maybe we aren't. There are some things that we have to deprioritise, but... I think we do beat ourselves up. We've decided because we, are lesser than Australia at the moment, and we're this terribly poor country now, and our wages are low. We're somehow a poor country. I think we need to be a little bit prouder than that. We are actually still in the very top echelons of the world wealth.
All right, thank you. Would you like to carry on and tell us?
Yeah,
what's
look,
on
very
your
briefly.
Mind?
I just had a plus and a minus, or a brickbat and a bouquet for John Key on race relations in the last few weeks. He does do a good Waitangi Day, I've got to say, John Key. He's at his best there. Really good speech at Waitangi. Affirmed Waitangi Day as our national day. Said that dealing with the grievances is something that is actually making us a better society. excuse me, and I don't think it got as much play as it deserved. On the other hand, if he needs to stop trying to beat up on refugees and playing that card, it's not classy at all. Refugees, we take few refugees. They are not. We are not in danger of being overwhelmed by hordes from Asia, and we need to get real on that. And he needs to stop playing some dirty pool on that one.
Does he need to say, "I'm brave going to Waitangi"? I mean, is he? Do you think?
Yeah, he is. I think it's a really good. It shouldn't be brave. It should be a given. I think it's important that it does keep going. But Clark didn't go, so the fact that and other politicians have refused to commit that they would go. So the fact that he does, I think, is to his credit.
All right. Thank you. 18 minutes to 5 o'clock. Richard Prosser again. He won't resign from Parliament for his anti-Muslim comments in Investigate magazine. He's apologised, well, insofar as he could. Hane Harawira got in the way of that one. But he's apologised for saying that young Muslim men should be banned from flying on Western Airlines. But after those comments went around the world, Parliament yesterday unanimously backed a Green Party call for religious and racial tolerance in a bid to limit damage to New Zealand's reputation. Does it damage New Zealand's reputation?
It's not a good look. I mean, I don't think it incites any great violence. He is a little-known backbencher. I certainly, you look on Google and I see it. Saw the story in the Gulf News in the Middle East. I saw it in around the world. So it doesn't do us any good at all. But I, on one hand, it is one of the dumbest things I've heard an MP say for a very, very long time. I mean, the comment just about young Muslim men was bad enough, but to say not anyone who looked like a Muslim, which would include Sonny Bill Williams and Tim Grosser, and anything in between, because there's quite a bit of a gap between those two, with all due respect to Tim. And anyone from a Muslim country, which would be about 24 million Indonesians, non-Muslim Indonesians, for example, on my count, shouldn't be able to have international travel. It's just so daft as to be unbelievable. But is it actually a sackable offence? I don't know if it's a job losing one.
Well, it's hard. What was his motivation? What prompted him? I mean, this is a man. He's like rarest of things. A man whose name is its own rhyming slang. He's unbelievable. He's sit down and he's written this thing, and he's now trying to claim it was a brain fart of some sort. Now those happen. Usually they are spontaneous things. He sat down at a computer and he wrote this. I mean, even if he just was typing this straight out, it's a 500-word article would take about 10, 15 minutes to type. This isn't just one of those sort of spontaneous mistakes. He put effort into this. The sense I get is he probably was trying to figure out, like, what can I say that's going to get some traction? What can I float that's going to get somewhere? Oh, let's see. We hate Muslims because they're all terrorists. Do we like that? Oh, no, we don't. Oh, I'll just apologise for that now. He's retracted it and said, oh, it was just a spur-of-the-moment thing. No, it wasn't. It was a thought-out thing.
No, yeah, that is the problem with the apology, is that it's the thing that you do first from your gut that tells you what you really think, not the damage control later that really can mean very little.
Yeah, the Prime Minister says, you know, so if he's apologised, he's just doing that to move on.
Well, of course.
But isn't that why all politicians and public figures apologise in the modern era? So we'll move on.
Yeah.
But what really concerns me is Winston Peters' response to him. Apparently he's reprimanded him, which basically means he's taken him aside and said, look, mate, don't make a fool of yourself in future.
Don't make a fool of me in the future.
Even worse. Yeah, God forbid. But it maybe shouldn't be a resigning offence, maybe it should be a sacking offence. I mean, Peter should come out and say, we distance ourselves from this, absolutely, this was abhorrent, he had no business saying this, it was not party policy. Well,
that's the political reality. So what we know now from this guy expressing, I'm also a little bit dubious about shutting down his ability to speak freely and make a complete dick of himself, but now we know that he's done that. We've seen that he is a fool. We have seen that New Zealand First accommodates that and says it's okay to have this fool in our party. We can then vote accordingly at the next election.
Is there a lot of rote piety going on as well? Because he is a cowboy, self-admitted cowboy columnist, who's a minor member of a party whose member, whose only MP most people know. Mm. Until something blows up, as Winston Peters. Yes. What I'm saying is, we know why the world's media seize on these stories, but should they?
Oh, I don't think even can have a should debate about that. They're going to. It's, if someone says something so daft, it grabs attention.
I know.
It's like going around with a silly hat on your head.
I know, but should we accept that? I mean, how far does that go in the end, the 24-hour news cycle where you trivialise or where you take... and I'm not saying this is a trivial matter, but when you take matters, utterances of relatively minor moment, and you send them global, how far can that go?
I agree, it can only go so far, but I think this is slightly different. It wasn't something off the cuff, it was something considered, as Steve said, and it was something said by still a public representative. So I think we are supposed to, and he wasn't tricked into it, it wasn't an ambush interview or anything, it came from his own volition. So I think we are the right to actually put it up there in large letters and tell him that we don't find that acceptable.
Okay, and can he survive?
Yeah, he can survive.
It's also worth bearing in mind, I mean, how long ago did he say this? 2 days ago, 3 days ago? We're still talking. Oscar Wilde was right. There is only one thing worse than being talked about. Mm. And the guy's done well. We all know it. Who had ever heard of Richard Prosser 3 days ago?
Not many. Mm. And the problem is that most of the people who had heard of him will still be agreeing with him anyway, because, yeah.
Tim Watkin.
There's an audience for that, sadly.
Steve McCabe on the panel, 13 minutes to 5. As we discussed yesterday, Australian entrepreneur Dick Smith looks like he's being sued by Heinz over claims on the labels of his cans of beetroot that their beetroot out of New Zealand is inferior. In fact, Dick has now gone further. He's quoted as saying that New Zealanders are useless at most things. New Zealand beetroot, I mean, what would the New Zealanders know about beetroot? They're bloody hopeless at everything. Dr. Steve Wrigley is the director of the Centre for Comparative Cultural Studies at Waikato University. Hello, Steve.
Yeah, kia ora. And that, by the way, is the first thing we do better than Australians. We say hello better.
Ah, because they say g'day?
Actually, they generally say, sorry, you're not eligible for a benefit, mate.
Trevor, what else do we do better?
We play rugby better, obviously. Our national anthem is better now that we sing it in Māori.
Yes, I think you're right there. And girt by sea. I mean, what is girt by sea?
See, girt is the name of a small town in New South Wales. I don't know why they put it in their anthem, because, like, most seaside towns in Australia, you can't actually swim there.
Swim there. I think.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, you can't swim at the beach in Gert. You can't swim at the beach at Gert because of jellyfish, and you can't swim in their rivers and lakes because of crocodiles.
Yes, although, of course, that isn't the fault of the Australians. I think Deke Smith's point is that New Zealanders aren't as good as Australians at doing things.
Yeah. I don't know what he's on about. With the white wine, Sauv Blancs.
Good point.
Yeah, throwing the discus, obviously. Coffee, that's one. Driving? A recent study showed that New Zealanders are the best, most courteous drivers in the world. We're actually outstanding on the road.
Where was this study done?
At Victoria. The Victoria Driving Academy in Lower Hutt.
Ah, I didn't know that.
See, that's the thing. We're not the sort of people who shout it out. We're just quietly competent, you see. NovaPay.
What about NovaPay? Oh, NovaPay.
Yes, yeah, Australians.
Take your point.
I'm not saying Australians are useless, you see. It's that they've invented those rollers that they use on cricket pitches, and they invented the dual flush toilet.
Did they invent the dual flush toilet?
Yep, but look at us. We split the atom. We flew first. What else? Jet boats, the egg beater, the hairpin.
The bungee?
The bungee, yeah. The Zorb and the whistle for referees.
That's right, in 1884. And, of course, next to that list, Dr. Steve Wrigley, canned beetroot doesn't seem very important.
Mate, it's about as important as sunblock at night.
Dr. Steve Wrigley, Director of the Centre for Comparative Cultural Studies at Waikato University.
Yeah, that's right, and you won't find any Australians on the faculty.
Actually, you won't find the faculty either. Comedian Steve Wrigley with us. Did you know we invented the referee's whistle?
No, I did not. I did not. You learned something new, Jim, with
that,
you.
We learned that today. But actually, when you stack up, I know Dick Smith's just having fun, actually, but when you stack up New Zealand's inventions and other achievements against Australia, we're pretty impressive.
We are.
Especially per capita.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, what Rutherford's famous line, we don't have any money, so we have to think harder.
Yeah.
We do.
Although the dual flush toilet is quite an impressive invention, and we all owe a big debt of gratitude.
And you say Dick Smith's being silly, but he's not. He's not. He's quite seriously trying to move units, isn't he? He's playing the jingoism card so he can actually sell some tins.
Yeah, it's publicity, isn't it?
Yeah.
And as we say back in England, what's the difference between Australia and yoghurt?
Pardon?
The difference between Australia and yoghurt is if you leave yoghurt on its own for 200 years, it'll develop a culture of its own.
That's a real English joke, that one.
Because we love our Aussie cousins, we really do.
Steve McCabe, Tim Watkin on the panel. A parliamentary committee has continued wrangling over whether the government should ban prostitution from Auckland's trouble spots. The committee heard submissions on the bill today, more than 2 years after it was introduced by former Labour MP George Hawkins. And there's been interest in the law change because other cities, in particular Christchurch, are keen to have similar powers to ban prostitution near schools, near family homes, near sports facilities, and so on. So, do you think, who should be doing this? Because Auckland City says, listen, the police should be doing it. We can't expect our council officers, you know, to move prostitutes on. First of all, should they be moved on? What's your view on this?
Prostitution's legal, isn't it?
Yes.
So if it's legal, then where's our problem with this? If we're saying that it shouldn't happen in certain places, then we have to start looking at why it shouldn't happen, and maybe we should start figuring that possibly that there is something that we have within our community values that say that we don't agree with prostitution, then we need to reconsider the laws. But if prostitution's officially legal, then where's the problem?
Well, because there are all kinds of legal things you can do which you don't necessarily want to do in front of children.
Okay.
For example, so perhaps near schools,
okay,
is a reasonable line to draw.
But what about Hunter's Corner in Auckland?
Well, this is it. I find this one incredibly difficult because where do you draw the line? That's exactly the problem. You might. I think you can probably make a decent case around schools. I don't want. I'm pleased that they're limiting liquor outlets X amount of miles away from or meters away from schools. I think probably you can put prostitution in that same box, but. But then where?
But we're basically we're NIMBY-ing here, really.
That's your reasonable point, isn't it? I mean, if you make a case against schools, you can probably, without too much of a strain, make a case against your children being aware of the brothel next door in the suburban street.
Yeah, you probably can. And the problem is if you then put it away from all family homes, you send it, what, into light industrial areas? And to be fair, again, to prostitutes, are you sending them into literally to back alleys? Because that is an unsafe environment for them to work in. So, I can really see problems on both sides.
Would it be fair to say, though, that a national law was passed, you know, giving rights and freedoms to prostitutes, which many people welcomed at the time, but which have turned out to be, in part, you know, great in theory, because when you apply them in practice, you start meeting this kind of opposition?
Yes.
And so how do you get around that? Because the opposition just seems to be constant as well, and the opposition includes rather large city councils. And do they have the right to say to prostitutes, listen, we want you a kilometre down the road, thanks, not outside our businesses?
Well, are we going to get into licensed red light zones?
Well, that's what used to happen, isn't it?
And
in fact, still does in areas of New Zealand.
Fair enough.
And the problem is that politics continues, isn't it? Is that even if you have a vote and the parliament has decided thus, that doesn't stop people talking, or it doesn't stop other forms of government having their say. So, and you wouldn't want it to stop. You wouldn't actually want councils not to be able to have a say in these things. So, again, I don't know. Sorry, too hard for me, Jim.
But the conversation is going to have to be very, very honest about it. We're going to have to say, do we accept prostitution as something that is acceptable within community morals? If it is, then we have to work within that context and say, OK, what is it about prostitution that means that we don't want to have it being advertised, if you'd like, say, near a school? What exactly is it? And you're going to have a very, very honest conversation. It's an awkward thing because it involves sex, it involves paying for sex, and this is something that we don't like to talk about. Mm. And people are going to be very, very uncomfortable having a public, open, honest discussion about it.
If the legislation passed, it would give police powers of arrest and the power to stop and search vehicles, and the bill would allow fines of up to $2,000.
But see, that is tough. If we say that it is a legal career choice, then you can't victimise those people for making that career choice.
Exactly, and we have made it legal, so we now have to deal with the consequences of that. Mm. You say, but that's fine, I just don't want it on my street.
It's a complicated one. 4 minutes to 5 o'clock. A wealthy couple who bought a leaky home have failed in a $2 million court case against the Auckland Council, but ratepayers will have to pay them $380,000-odd. Despite a High Court judge saying they were largely the authors of their own misfortune. And just to recap the case, Ross and Linda Johnson bought a property in Takapuna for $3.9 million at a mortgagee sale back in 2009. Their dream home was then discovered to have weather tightness problems, and the couple spent $3.7 million on remedial work and interior renovation, and that repair bill alone was $1.9 million. So then they took legal action against the Auckland Council, as its predecessor, the North Shore City Council, had issued a code of compliance certificate for significant alterations to the house. And the previous owners had resourced consent for new rooms and a basement, but not the recladding of the entire house that took place, and that was found to be defective. So they had a lot of money and managed to get it done. But what do you think? I mean, should you, in theory anyway, be able to rely on a code of compliance certificate when you buy a house? What's your view on that?
Call me crazy, but if I was spending $4 million on a house, I think I'd be looking for a builder's report.
Yeah. It is remarkable they didn't see the book. I mean,
did this not get flagged up at any stage in the purchase process?
Well, the judge in his ruling said, I'm satisfied they took a calculated risk.
Yeah.
So the suggestion that there was some flagging, there was some awareness of weather tightness problems.
Or did they possibly, and I'm speculating obviously here, but is it possible that they bought this with the idea in mind that if issues do arise, then, there's always the leaky building compensation, we can fall back on somebody else to pay for it for us?
I don't think there's any suggestion of that. I think what the judge...
I'm being cynical here, I realise.
No, but I think what the judge was implying was that perhaps they bought it with a degree of impulsiveness.
Mm.
But, you can buy anything with a degree of impulsiveness and you're still entitled, to expect goods of merchantable quality.
That's right, and you should expect that a local authority should be able to stand behind their paperwork.
But MTORs really ought to caveat, though.
Mm. All right, so you think that actually
trumps? I think when you're spending that kind of money, you need to have your eyes wide open. I think that there's a degree of recklessness and impulsiveness there, yes.
But it goes to the heart of the leaky homes problem for everybody, which is that, yes, there is culpability with the owners, and there is culpability with the council, and there is culpability with the builders, and there is culpability with the building products manufacturers, and this is the problem. There are so many, and there are culpability with the architects. There are so many people to blame in this who actually pays.
But when I was looking to buy a house 2.5 years ago, I looked at one property that had all the hallmarks of a potential leaky home. It had no evidence of it yet, but the way it was constructed, the design of the place, screamed possible future leaky home nightmare.
Yeah.
And we liked the house and we walked away from it because we weren't willing to take to roll the dice on that
one. In 2009, they bought this place. By 2009, we knew about leaky
homes. Yeah, it was only 2010 when I was buying mine. It's not that long after.
You can't guarantee with a builder's report that you can find the potential leaks either. No. I mean, you can with a good one. You might not be lucky enough to do so.
No, but you can look at certain houses and say there are certain features about this house that say that it has an enhanced possibility.
With a crack running down the cladding. For example, yes. Yeah.
Okay.
No, it's not always plain, though, is it? I think Mr. Prosser spoke his mind. Just some quick opinion from the listeners before we go. No other business can legally sell services on any street corner, so why should the selling of prostitution be any different, says Leon of Christchurch.
So they have to open a shop.
I think, well, there's a big shop opening in the middle of Auckland.
Yes, exactly. Yes, I was just thinking that.
Casino shortly. I think Mr. Prosser spoke his mind. This is a democracy, and luckily we can still express our political views. Is this what you were saying earlier, that at the bottom of all this, that's what trumps everything?
No, not trumps, because I think there is so much stupidity in the statement that actually you can't just hide behind free speech. But yes, he does have the right to say that. And as I say, we can see he's a fool and we can not vote for him next time.
Tim Watkin has been on the panel. Thank you, Tim.
Cheers, mate.
Steve McCabe as well.
Thank you very much.
Buy a lot tonight on your way home. But just a bit of casual advice. Thanks, everybody. Checkpoint Fellows. We're back tomorrow.